This is Developer Stories, where we ask you why you built it, and we look behind the scenes of some of tech's passion projects and people. Welcome to the show. You're in the right place.
Welcome to Developer Stories. I'm Vanessa Sockett, and joining me today is Jay Lofsted, principal member of the technical staff in the Scalable Systems Software Group at Sandia National Laboratories. I met Jay through some work related to I/O and data management, and he has been an immense source of wisdom, not just about science and careers, but also taught me about the importance of ice cream. So Jay, it is a great honor to have you on the show today.
Well, thank you, Vanessa. Glad to be here.
So let's start with the basics. Tell us about your training and background and how you entered this high-performance computing world.
That's a fairly long answer that I'll try to keep relatively reasonable. So I started with my undergrad degree, and I went into industry not knowing how grad school worked. And I worked at Siemens Energy and Automation doing programming packages for industrial controls. So that is the software that runs all of the actuators and switches and belts and things that actually make a factory work. So that's a high security, high sensitivity kind of environment for software quality and things like that. After there, I went to what became McKesson. And at McKesson, we were doing hospital automation systems for clinicians. So it was all of the workflows that a clinician would use in order to do their job, but it was not the software for things like the lab equipment that would evaluate a sample to figure out what the lab value would be. And as the last part of my job there, this was in 1999 and 2000, I was basically looking to do something different. And my dad happened to sit outside the CTO's office and had talked to him. And the CTO said, "Hey, before you leave, why don't you come look at something we're doing?" And I went and looked. And what they were trying to do was to make a system that integrated all the various different systems that McKesson had bought over the years. They grew through acquisition, but never really did a good integration on it. And wanted to know if they could do a web-based integration for it. And I looked at that and I said, yeah, I think that's something I can do. So at that point, we formed a team of about five people. They gave us a little bit of seed money and said, let's see what you can do. And we ran a startup from that core idea all the way through to working with the customers and doing the delivery and all the sales and everything else like that. In the process, the project was extremely successful. They generated somewhere in the neighborhood of $4 billion in revenue from the product. But as is always the case with these kinds of things, the technical people frequently will lose control of it to the business people. And it was time for me to move on. But I couldn't get the same kind of job, even an interview elsewhere, because I only had a bachelor's degree. So I ended up going to grad school. And in the process, I learned about high-performance computing because I really knew nothing about it previously. And at the same time, discovered what the research side of things was. And when I saw that I could actually get re-involved with science rather than business, and at the same time, do some really hard, high-end kind of software developments, like, okay, I finally found a real home for me. So that's how I ended up getting started and getting involved. Sandia approached me through my advisor and somebody he knew at Sandia back 2005-ish or something, and asked if he had a student that would be interested in potentially working with them, and asked me if I was interested. And I said, sure, why not? And in the process, discovered that this was a place that offered me an environment where, again, I had to deal with this high quality requirement kind of software, but at the same time, got to work with science and engineering and also do things for national and global interest.
You said in the very early on that you entered all of this without knowing how graduate school worked. And that really kind of hit me because I go back to that time when I was finishing college and a lot of my, you know, fellow students would say, oh yeah, I've been doing research and I'm going to medical school. And I had no idea what they were talking about. I didn't know what research is. I didn't have any context of what someone would even do in graduate school. Can you take us back to your mindset then and kind of walk us through what you meant by you didn't know? And then my real question is, do you think that has persisted in today where a lot of students are finishing up with college and maybe graduate school would be a great place for them, but they don't have a firm understanding of what that actually means?
Okay, so the place that I got started in is I'm a first generation college student. And because of that, my family never could give me real guidance or advice. For example, in high school, I worked 40 to 60 hours a week, in addition to going to high school and having an active social life, and was part of several clubs at school just to keep my mind busy. And they said, you could do better in school. And I said, yeah, I have a 3.2 GPA. I could do better, but I'm having fun doing all of this other stuff. What is better? And they never had an answer for me. And because of that, I just kept doing the things that were interesting for me. And when I got into undergrad, it was really the same kind of thing. Because again, there was just no guidance saying, this is what grad school is, this is what grad school requires, this is what research is. And because of that, I went through basically in the same kind of way where I was doing things that I enjoyed at the same time as doing my classes. And I ended up getting out of undergrad with a 3.2 GPA as well. And the challenge for me there is that one of the reasons nobody talked to me about grad school is that they look for people with a 3.5 or higher GPA. And if I had known that was what they were looking for, I would have done different things. For example, taking fewer class hours at a time and spreading things out a bit more than I already did, and other things like that that would give you more time and be able to focus and get better grades. But again, I had no idea. 10 years after I got out of undergrad, because I went into industry because I graduated undergrad thanks to my parents with no debt, but broke. And so to go to grad school, because again, I didn't know any better, I figured I had to go make and save money, and then I could afford to go back to grad school. And as I was going through all of the process of going through industry and everything, I got very good at being a software engineer. And I really didn't think that much about grad school anymore because I had a really good position and was able to be very efficient, and people really liked my work. So there was no real strong motivation until I hit the I can't move on to a different job that is the same level that I was at. At that point, I really started to look at grad school and I got angry because nobody had told me what all of the rules were. And once I saw that, I realized I could have done very different things and gone to grad school years earlier and not had worry about it. It is still a big problem today. One of the big things that I do when I go to college campuses is I talk to undergrads, particularly ones that are doing really well. And if they, for example, tell me they're doing two bachelor's degrees, I just interrupt them and say, why? And usually they have a terrible answer, such as, oh, I want to have a broader basis on this. And I ask them, what's better, having a two bachelor's degrees or a bachelor's and a master's degree? They'll admit that a master's degree would be better, but they want that broader coverage. And so I'll tell them, whatever you want to be your primary is what you minor in as undergrad. And then you swap it for your grad degree. And doing something different in your grad degree is normal. And then when it comes to however everybody does hiring, which is you sort by degree level, then you sort by GPA, you'll be in the master's category rather than the bachelor's category. And that's usually enough to get people to stop and think and say, oh, okay, maybe I need to get some more information on it and go do other things. The other piece that I try to do is if they tell me they're doing one of the 4+1 bachelor's plus master's program, is again, I'll ask them why. And invariably, the answer is it's easy. Occasionally, I'll get an answer that is more thoughtful, saying, I know what research is and I'm just not interested. I really want to go get a job, or PhD seems like it will take a lot of time. And I just start asking them questions about what does getting a PhD mean? What kind of jobs can you get with a PhD versus a master's versus a bachelor's? And I work through going through what all the options are and why they would want to do different ones, because we need people that do the jobs of each of the degree levels. It's a question of what's the right degree level to get the kind of job that you want. And very often the students that are in that like 3.8 and above kind of GPA, they really want to do that deep thought kind of work that is really the realm of what PhDs do, but they don't understand that because they're also frequently coming from either a first generation college family or somebody with no advanced degrees in their family. And in both of those cases, again, they have no guidance. So I try my best to try to relate as much of that as I can. And that's one of the things that I do regularly at conferences and other events. It's just, why are you doing the degree you're doing? If you have good reasoning, great, I'll support you on it. If not, let me give you some information so that you can make an informed decision and do what is really right for you. This is really a conflict with me and the recruiting work I do at Sandia a little bit, because we hire primarily people with master's degrees. And I meet many people that I think would be great PhD candidates. And I don't want to see them stop at a master's degree unless that's what they want to do. I would rather they go and get the level of education that will let them do the job they want and then come work at Sandia. And over the years, since I've been doing recruiting for a long time now, we've seen people re-engage with us after starting more advanced degree programs and coming back. And repeatedly they say, nobody's ever told me this information. Thank you. And this has really been helpful. And they'll follow up with me in email and ask me more questions later. So it's something I think is really important, is to try to make sure that this whole process of getting the right level of education for the job you want to do gets out there as much as possible.
There's a lot to unpack here.
Yes.
So it sounds like there's a bias for students to enter careers for research or graduate school that are aware that that's an option to them. So either they have some kind of background or their family is able to say, like, this is an option for you. This is what that means. And it sounds like a lot of those students tend to not be in marginalized groups. Because what I'm also hearing is this pattern, because we're talking about college as this means to get knowledge and skills for a career. But I've seen a lot of college experiences where people are in survival mode. They don't have the luxury to think about their career and what courses they're taking. They're experiencing medical adversity or financial adversity, and akin to you, they're working all the time, or they're just trying to, you know, to make it to classes and to pass. And so thinking about their career is an afterthought, and then they likely get to this point of graduation and they say, oh my goodness, now I need to make money and I need a job. And that's the point that they start thinking about it. So I don't know that there's an answer here, but it's, I guess, step back. What is the right point to start thinking about career, especially if you can't? And what can, you know, folks later in their careers, such as me, such as you, what can we do to help make it a more equitable landscape?
This is actually one of the reasons why I've gotten involved in a lot of recruiting, one, and then also DEI related efforts as well, is that my PhD admissions class had 75 people in it. 73 of them had one, but most had both parents with a PhD already, most of whom were in academia. And because of that, those students from high school had been coached and told exactly what they needed to do to not just get into, but be successful in a PhD program. And for them, they were just following the formula and doing what they were told, and it was relatively easy. For somebody like me or anybody from a disadvantaged group, they're coming in, they have no context, they have no support structure, and they're being asked to navigate a process that nobody has really well documented or explained. And it is a terrible, terrible situation in terms of trying to increase the diversity of people in these kinds of programs. So when we get to trying to get people who are in survival mode into these programs, I've run into many, many of them. And I'll give you an example. I was talking with some students from Florida International University. That's obviously in Florida. It's Miami, if I remember right. But they were only in their bachelor's program because the school was paying for their degree. The idea of doing graduate school was completely off the table, and this was 100% paid for. That was one of the things I got angry about when I understood it, was that PhD programs, particularly in STEM fields, are free tuition, and you get paid a stipend to go to school. You still have to pay the, quote, required school fees. Those can sometimes be waived, though. And back in the 2002 to 2010 timeframe, when I was in grad school, the stipend was $25,000 a year. Not a lot of money, but if you live carefully and get a decent internship for the summer, you can actually live simply but quite comfortably for the entire time you're in grad school. And this is one of the things that's just not known. And if you're looking at how do I make it from today to tomorrow because of money issues, and then you find out I could actually go do what I want to do because I'll actually get the money that I need just by the process of being in school and hired as a researcher or a teaching assistant, that's a complete game changer. And that's one of the things that I try to make sure I tell people up front. And the second piece that goes with that is, pretty well universally, if you hate everything about a PhD program, and I mean that very specifically, because there are things that you are bad at that you don't like because you're bad at them. For example, many computer science people, myself included, were not great writers. And that was one of the reasons that we steered towards the technology side of things. It was something that we could do that was not a subjective evaluation about the quality of what we were doing. It was purely objective. Did it work or did it not work? And because of that, when you get into grad school and realize I have written and verbal communication that I have to do, and I'm just not good at it, it's a skill you learn as part of grad school. And if you decide that you can learn those skills and you only dislike them because you're bad at them, then you can stay in. But if you truly realize, hey, this research thing where I'm trying to go and solve problems that people don't have answers for, and I'm working in areas where I have to basically try things randomly and wonder if they're going to work or not. I have to be systematic about it, but I may be trying things randomly. And that is a low productivity environment for somebody that's used to really cranking a lot of code quickly. And if they're good at that and they want to stay doing that, then drop out with a master's degree. And because of the coursework requirement you generally have, you'll get that done along the way. And then you drop out with a master's degree that they paid for. And those kinds of options are just not explained to people. And they're almost open secrets that the schools don't really want to tell you. But different schools have different dropout rates for PhD programs. I can say I know three particularly. Johns Hopkins has about a 10% dropout rate for their PhD in computer science. Georgia Tech is about a 50% dropout rate. And UC Santa Cruz, because they're right next to the Bay Area and startups all come and poach students all the time, they have about a 90% dropout rate. And so there is an expectation that they're going to lose students, and they want to be able to get some value out of that because of their school statistics for the rankings and such. But they don't really want people to drop out with a master's. They want them to come into the PhD program expecting to graduate that way. And so that's another part of the wrestling that goes on with what the schools are willing to tell people versus what the people need to know so that they can go into the programs with confidence. That's another issue, is just, am I good enough to do this? And the answer is if somebody's talking to you about it, you probably are. It's just a question of, is it what you want to do? And is it the right thing for you?
Wow. That's huge variability, up to 90%. Most people, do you have a sense of over the years how the actual recruitment rate has changed? So, for example, I would imagine that different schools have different sources for funding their PhDs, and the number that they can take on is going to vary. And of course, that's also influenced by how many they expect to drop out. Do we have a universe where the number of opportunities to get a PhD is expanding or shrinking or staying about the same?
Historically, computer science has been a great field for getting into from a computer science, from a money perspective and from a jobs perspective, because there's so much demand. And because there's so much demand, there's a lot of money that's floating around because people are, I'm willing to pay you and I'm willing to pay you more just to have the opportunity to hire you. The typical grant writing process, if you get grants from like National Science Foundation or Department of Energy or Department of Defense, those grants historically have just been topic related. They're starting to have grants related to things like ethics and technology, and they're trying to target underrepresented schools and groups. I know I did some grant reviews a year or two ago that were aimed at having a faculty member from an underrepresented serving institution be embedded at a national lab and essentially do tech transfer from the lab to the faculty member and establish a working relationship so there would be a pathway from the school to the lab for the students that would be graduating. And it's a great program for trying to increase diversity. The other piece that goes with it is that companies are at least giving lip service. I don't know that we have good stats that say they're really doing the things necessary to try to keep people long-term or truly grow the populations, but they want to be able to improve their numbers as far as diversity go. And because of that, they're also giving more attention to how do I fund underrepresented groups to go to graduate school. Finding out about these opportunities, again, it's a lot of insider information, and you have to know who to talk to in order to find out what opportunities are available.
So you said that when you were still a student, you found high performance computing, and that was interesting to you. And one thing that I think about often is that, at least when we're younger, we sort of stumble along and we just get exposed to many different things. And at some point, there's some signal that something is really interesting or sticky to us that sticks out, and then we kind of pursue that path. So if you're talking to a student and they haven't found that sticky thing yet, and they're sort of, maybe they're taking a bunch of computer science courses and they think it's all okay, what would you tell them in terms of advice for finding something that really captures them? And then as a follow-up, like, what happens if they don't find that thing?
I will say up front, I have had at least one student I know who was great, but didn't ever find the thing that was sticky for him. And because of that, he dropped out of the PhD program because he could do anything that needed to be done, and he did it well and he did it quickly. But we, and meaning DOE people plus his faculty advisors plus the other places he had interned, had all given him a variety of things to do, but nothing stuck. He just went and, I believe, became a production programmer somewhere. As far as trying to get people to think about what's interesting for them, the dual undergrad degree people are really kind of the right audience because I go and talk with high school groups. Probably it's been a few years just because of COVID, but I try to do that at least once or twice a year. And when I do, one of the things I emphasize for them is that computing basically permeates all of science today. And you can either do computing with a heavy dose of science by going through the basic sciences, or you can support all the basic sciences by going through the computing and helping to build the scientific computing infrastructure, because that's really what my job is to help build that infrastructure. And if people haven't found what they wanted, then basically look around, try different courses. What is it that you'd like to do as a hobby even? Sometimes that can give people an insight into what works for them. The way that I got into high performance computing was the projects that I had done with McKesson, that last startup project, that was building a big web-based interface and for a lot of different applications. And those all ran on literally dozens, if not hundreds, of servers behind the scenes, and you're running a large hospital complex or a multi-location hospital complex. And because of that, things had to be scalable and handle volumes of data that I, for example, had not initially considered. So I built a workflow system that used an XML storage format and then the XSLT transformers, so that I could convert the XML into either a web-based form for things like digital signatures or using XSLFO, the formatting objects, I could convert it into PDF documents. And I set up a multi-stage workflow through allowing people to configure what the XSLT transformations and the input and the output on the XML files were. What I didn't know, and I didn't get a sense of at the time when I was writing the system, was what the message rate was going to be. And I initially thought, okay, this is something that might be several hundred to say 1,000 per day. And what it ended up being was more like maybe as much as 100 per minute. And those data rates, all of a sudden, and your database infrastructure and your indexing and things like that, all of a sudden are completely inadequate. And that was one of my 100-hour work weeks I had done while I was in industry, is on site, seeing the system melt down. I've basically worked every hour that I could be awake, rejiggering the system around so that it would have the performance that was necessary, that it was usable. And those are the kinds of things that really led me to want to work on large, complex systems. And when I discovered high performance computing, it's like, oh, finally, an area with a level of complexity that makes things really hard rather than I can have full control over everything. And that makes things dramatically easier. So that's what makes me happy.
Oh my gosh, I just had a really funny mental imagery of like, okay, imagine a cartoon guy and he's sitting at the end of a conveyor belt and there's like, I don't know, sushi coming down the conveyor belt and he expects a particular rate and the sushi comes down. Maybe it's like a cartoon cat actually, and the cat like eats the sushi. But then like the actual rate of the conveyor belt like just really speeds up and all of a sudden all of the sushi's like piling on him and he turns into the cat disappears and you just see a pile of sushi. So that was basically you. Get down to a cartoon. Oh, that's really interesting. So you're still working very heavily in, you know, scientific data in IO. So that interest has really persisted.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, the core of what I do always has data. When I got out of undergrad, my two emphasis areas for my degree were business systems and databases. And the work that I did on my co-op job was, they were a database consulting company. So we built custom applications that were essentially database front ends for companies and did a lot of database-based training. Then with Siemens, that was a big multinational effort. And the challenge there was a lot of politics, one. But the other one was, we had to make sure my job there was the interface layer between the people in the United States who were doing the visual-based editors for the programming languages and the people in Germany who were doing the machine code-based compiled form of those languages that got run on the controllers. And no, that was not a pleasant place to be when the two sides were fighting, which was basically the entire time I was there. But that was another case where it was a big data management issue. Then when I get to McKesson, it's 100% a data management issue. Everything's like your medical record and all of the data that streams in when you have a hospital stay or even a doctor's visit. And it's how do we manage these data volumes in a way that gives us the kind of performance that we need for an interactive system, but at the same time maintains things while they are clinically valid and relevant. But at the same time, we also need to take care of things like billing, because we need to pay for our services and so we can all have salaries and pay for supplies and stuff. So I'd really just always had a strong data center and I've continued that. And what I've ended up expanding into is some machine learning based things. And based off of some other things that I was doing, I got involved in reproducibility, which kind of crudely is very much a data management problem as well, because it's about collecting enough data so that you can be able to reproduce the problem's solution again. So I ended up doing that. And now I do trustable machine learning kind of things and workflows. And workflows are really a big data flow problem of how do I take the data that goes through the first component and then we have an output generated that goes into a second component and so on. Is how do I manage those, the executable pieces and the data pieces? And then the big science applications are all huge data generators. And so, again, it just comes back to all of these massive data volumes and how do we make it so that we can be productive using these volumes in a way that's useful for either the problem at hand or for society or for people's health or whatever reason.
I was about to ask about reproducibility. So let's talk about the life cycle of a piece of data. And I can give you a concrete example. So in neuroimaging with fMRI, you collect the raw imaging data on the scanner, it comes out in something called a P file. The P file usually gets processed by the scanner into a format. So that could be a format called NIFTY. And then it's the NIFTY that gets sent to the researcher. Now, in the processing of fMRI, there's a gazillion different intermediate files after you do various steps like segmentation and registration. And, you know, you're going to be starting with some format of a raw data, generating a lot of intermediate data, ending up usually with individual maps and then likely a group map and then likely analyses derived from that. So when you have, I guess there's a spectrum of reproducibility where on one side you could say we must keep everything. It's all important. If anyone needs to look at one step, it should be available because we'd never be able to process it again in the exact same way on the same machines. On the other end, it's like, well, we can keep kind of the raw, the original data files, and then we can kind of keep the final result and throw out everything in between. How does a researcher decide where to operate on that dimension?
That's a very difficult question because I think there were many researchers that are overconfident. One example is that at Sandia, we do a lot of national security related applications, and there's an assumption after the scientist has validated that they believe the application is correct, is that the application is correct. And because of that, they have a strong belief without really understanding the full environment that they can regenerate the same result later. And whether they can or not is something that's up for debate. Personally, I know enough about how systems work and how the systems upgrades occur and how many software patches we get, particularly things like security patches that often break things because security holes were taken advantage of, even inadvertently. And I look and I say, I want a stronger standard that gives us the confidence that we need to be able to ensure that we know exactly where things came from. For the fMRI example, that really is a question of when do we know that we have enough information that given the need and the access to resources that we can regenerate what is considered the equivalent result. And if you can get access to the machine, and for say there's a legal case and you didn't store all that initial data, then you need to be able to go back from some observational data, like the raw data, which you probably would store, and then go through the processing elements, knowing what versions of things were used for all the different processing to be able to go and say, can I generate the same thing or not? Or was the observation wrong in the first place? And one of the things that I have as a project right now is we're looking at how do we take a fine-grained workflow that we store every element, be it an application segment or the data, which we also, and we put everything into containers that are immutable, and we annotate every container with the environment and sources that were used to create it. So we have an application, you have an input deck, and you have input data that generates output data. The output data gets annotated with the application container ID, the input deck container ID, and the input data container ID. And then in addition to environment information, you can then be able to look at it and say, okay, I know where this data came from. Ideally, we would have the entire system set up that way so that you'd know what the compiler versions were, what the third-party libraries were, what the operating system was, even have emulators for the hardware that you could trust so that you could then truly get back and look at everything. That's kind of my career goal that I know is impossible to reach. But part of the question we're looking at there is, how much can we collapse the steps in the middle so we don't have to store as much data? And part of that is we can add the additional annotations downstream so that we know what application components and such were used for the intermediate steps. But there's also an issue of, did we capture everything or not? Because if we didn't capture everything, then that collapsing phase may be actually be worse than trying to run things directly, because you'd be able to look at it and say, oh yeah, I forgot about this other component that we have here. So some people want bitwise reproducibility. Some people say IEEE floating point numbers are not exact and they accumulate error over time and you'll never get the same result out of them twice. So they want something that is statistically the same. And other people look at it and say, as long as I can draw the same conclusion, I'm okay. And it's just a question of what the scientist and the domain has tolerance for in terms of things being, quote, the same for reproducibility to really work.
Those are really good points. And I agree about kind of this dimension of reproducibility. When you say container, do you mean a Linux container or some other container abstraction to hold different things?
Yeah, so back in, I think, 2017, we published the first step of this process, and it was at the VHPC workshop at ISC, and we called it data palettes. And the idea was is that we used Singularity containers because they, unlike standard Linux containers, were a storage device in a file instead of just a file system in a file. And that meant that we could take all this provenance information and attach it as part of the container, but it would be invisible to the application and the data, so you wouldn't corrupt anything. But if you wanted to look at it, all you had to do was to mount that other partition of this container. And ideally, your data and your provenance information. And data could mean application or data, because an application is the output data from a compiler that processed source code, which was also data. So when I say data, I just mean any sort of byte stream kind of thing. So you could look at that and then understand where that thing came from. And so that's really been the benefit for us with Singularity Containers. One of the things that I need as far as like a student to work with me is somebody that is a good Linux kernel hacker that understands Linux containers. And I need really two first things out of them. The first one is how do we expand a container beyond the bounds of a single node? And the real way to think about that is if the output from my simulation is 100 terabytes, I don't have a single node anywhere where I could fit 100 terabytes into main memory. So I need to be able to create a container remotely that multiple processes can mount and write into simultaneously. And when they're all done, then you make it immutable. And then you have a snapshot that can get annotated and say, it came from this application, this input deck, and so on. So that's one part. And the other part is that we'd like to get this multi-partition format into the OCI format so that we can still take advantage of this as OCI really ends up taking over the world. We don't really care so much that every container system supports it as much as the ability to have that there and then having at least one container system where we can then go and look at and read and write that data is really what we want.
Gotcha. So I asked because I was one of the original Singularity developers, and I remember there was about a year, I do think it was around 2017, where the idea of a data container was really common and popular. And, you know, there were lots of promises about it. I'm not sure we ever actually delivered on that. I wound up prototyping basically containers that didn't have file systems. So they were essentially scratch, and then you would add data on the fly. And then there would be a small, actually, I think it was a Go binary that I did so that you could actually query and understand the data without needing to actually have an operating system. I really love the problem that you're working on. I can think of kind of tricks or hacks to do it. I was going to follow up with a question. What do you do when you have a, you know, many terabytes of data, and that's going to be really hard to put in a, you know, a single Singularity container, which is SIF or a SquashFS file system. I do think there's going to be a lot of benefit to OCI. So just to kind of give you a taste of things we're working on, we have a compatibility working group that right now is concerned with extracting metadata about container images, specifically for the case of, well, there's actually many cases, but one example is just running it. Okay, is this container from this registry? I've matched it based on platform, but maybe I have 10 containers with the same platform and they actually have different MPI variants, and I want to find the right MPI variant for my environment. Which one is it? And so that's the very simple use case. But one thing that's very much stuck out to me is the fact that that kind of matching, that kind of metadata and understanding kind of the guts of the container via an artifact has so many other use cases. So workflows, but I also think data is one of them too. What I'll say to you is to kind of keep an eye out for this new artifact type or specification. It's not clear exactly what it's going to be yet. We're still deciding, but I think there will be use cases for data containers, and especially that use case that you're talking about where you need to kind of split things across nodes, which is undoubtedly going to happen because data is super chunky.
Yeah. Well, this is good to hear and good to know, because I was thinking about this when I just saw containers. I said, oh, file system in a file. I can do all sorts of stuff with that. And then I started to look and it's like, what do you mean I can't do data stuff? And then I stumbled upon the Singularity pieces and it's like, oh, I have a partial solution here. And then we started experimenting with it, trying to figure out how to make it work. And we've made progress. But yeah, again, there's those fundamental system issues of things like really big containers. As I've tried to explain to applications people what it is I want to design as a new scientific computing environment, which is basically everything in containers that are annotated, as well as having a virtualized operating system so that we can know precisely what the environment is, that we could then, again, add to this provenance list, still be 100% Linux, so we don't have to worry about incompatibilities or a custom environment again. But the applications people, they say, can I have this now? They really want something like this because it makes their life so much better. And just in terms of knowing where their data came from, which input deck did this data, the output come from? And from a reproducibility standpoint, since journals and conferences are starting to require that, they now can just say, here it all is. And those kinds of things make their life better. As I've tried to explain this to many computer science people over the last really 8 years, I started in 2015 in this, invariably they would say, why would you do that? Containers don't work that way. And my answer is, but they could. And that was part of the frustration, but at the same time, for me, the excitement on the research environment is that you could look at things and say, but they could work that way. And then it's a question of, can you make it work that way? And through that, you can end up really changing the way things are done and making things better. And that's really what I like on the research environment.
Absolutely. And there's something called ORAS, or OCI Registry of Storage, that explicitly uses container registries for blobs. And those blobs are usually data and entire infrastructure. So for example, Conda Forge will have mirrors with packages that you get a manifest via an artifact, and then you look up another one and you pull down binaries again from artifacts. So I'm not a student, and I think, you know, working with you, the opportunity should go to a student. But if you ever want to talk about these ideas with me, I love, like, ridiculously love container technologies, and I'd love to think about this and brainstorm with you. So please.
Yeah, let's follow up later. So
gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah. So the one last thing I would say on that is, machine learning is something that is affecting everything today. And even after the bubble completely bursts, it's still going to affect everything because it's become a useful tool. And part of the challenge that we have is that we don't know how models were generated. And if we can take the data that was used to train models in the first place and have it in containers and then annotate the models, which the containers that contain the data that they were trained with, we'll get a lot more traceability into how these models came to be and what the sources potentially or the bias that they exhibit might be. So that's the other place where I see this as having potentially big social impact, is being able to trace back in currently semi-opaque to mostly opaque systems and at least get to the original data that was used to create it, so that we can then make an analysis and say, what is it about this that could potentially lead to those outcomes?
Do you think that containers as sort of a unit of transport are also going to help with moving between, for example, HPC environments and cloud?
So that's what kind of why I want everything to be in containers and with a virtualized operating system image, is cloud works that way today largely. And the only reason why the HPC centers don't work that way is biased by the machine administrators. I've started conversations with a few of them and said, why don't we have a virtual machine OS image that we can keep track of, as well as all of these other modules and things, rather than a raw machine install that gets upgrades over time and we don't really quite know what's there? And they always look at it from the current infrastructure doesn't really support that. And at the same time, there's the difficulty in maintenance. It's easy for them to go install software on a running system. It's hard for them to then go build a container image or multiple container images and then deploy them everywhere. They see that as additional effort that is outside their current tool set. So I think that's another part of the challenge, is that it could be exactly the same. It's just a matter of the HPC environment needs to lean in a bit into using these kinds of tools. And the performance argument may be valid, and that's something that's fixable, but I don't think that there's a strong argument. I think that's only a weak argument.
Gotcha. And I share sort of an optimistic future vision that we are moving toward something that we've talked about, converged computing, where we do get the best of both worlds and we have environments in HPC that have more attributes of cloud, and it's easier then to take our stuff from HPC and move it over there. That could be an entire other podcast conversation though, so I won't open up that rabbit hole.
Yes, right. Indeed.
So we're coming up on time. I want to ask just a few more questions. Jay, we have not talked about ice cream.
No.
can you tell us about the HPC Gelato Group?
Sure. I have been a frozen dairy fan for basically my entire life, as many people have. And Shadi Ibrahim, who's at INRIA in France, he and I both, whenever we end up traveling together, we always end up going and getting gelato somewhere. And we went to Eurosys in Rome last year. And Rome has a lot of really good gelato places. And I managed to get gelato 16 times in 7 days. And yes, that was 2-3 gelato days. Those were really nice. So one of the students that we work with together, Redita Lim, who's at RWTH in Aachen, she said to me, after participating in many of these outings that we do, we should make an ice cream club for the supercomputing conference. And I thought about it for a week and I said, okay, I have one better. Why don't I make a LinkedIn group that is for people in the HPC field as a social get together that may or may not include frozen dairy? And so I just created it. And in the process of about 3 months now, there's 125 people that have joined, much to my utter surprise. So we use it whenever somebody that's involved goes to a conference, they can post it and say, hey, who's interested in getting together and going get some gelato or some ice cream? And it's a good way to meet different people and to at the same time get something tasty. The only real rule for rules, there's a couple for joining the group, because I do keep it as a private group, is number one, you have to have some HPC connection because it's really kind of a social group for HPC. And then the second one is that you have to be willing to accept anybody and everybody for who they are. If you're not willing to do that, then you're just not welcome. So I guess the one last thing I would add on that is that the way it really got started is that in Vancouver, British Columbia, there is a gelato shop where the owner went to the international gelato competitions in Italy and won. Yes, the gelato there is fantastic. And I had known about it. And then when IPDPS was in Vancouver 1 year, Trilce Estrada from University of New Mexico and I were running the student programs. And I said to her, hey, I think we should go get gelato. And I explained, and she said, yeah, it sounds like a good idea. So we just told the students early on, and we said, okay, we're going to skip the next session. We're not telling you you should skip the next session, but we're going to go about 5 blocks down and get gelato from this gelato shop. And I explained about it. I said, if you'd like to come, you're welcome to come. Otherwise, enjoy the session. And basically all the students came, and what we had not planned on, but they all started talking as we walked 5 blocks over to the gelato shop. They talked the entire time they were in line. They talked the entire time they were eating, and they talked the entire time we walked back. And for the rest of the conference, they were super tight as a group. And at that point, she and I, Trilce and I, looked at each other like, we have discovered like the ultimate team bonding activity for a group of strangers. And that is, go do something fun together. And what's more fun than getting ice cream? And that's how we all really kind of got started doing this as an organized activity.
You found the secret. Okay, so really quickly, what is the last flavor that you remember having that was just absolutely surprising and spectacular?
Okay, I don't shop by flavor. That's the number one rule for me. I shop by color. And so the first thing that I do is I try to go to a place that's really all natural. So it's not a lot of artificial colors or flavors, because you can get really far into the weeds if you go and then you look for unnatural colors at a place like that, because they may truly be very unnatural. The two I would say that I had, one was in Sicily, and it was not Sicily, in Cyprus back in October, and it was gray. And I looked at that and they said, here, taste this. I said, no, I don't need to taste it. It's a weird color. I have to have it. They said, no, taste it anyway. And it was black vanilla. So you take aged vanilla beans, then you pack them in sugar, and then you age them for like 3 more weeks. And the beans are like $20 a piece or something ridiculous like that. But the flavor was just really absolutely outstanding. The other one was in Copenhagen, and I looked and there was this one kind of bright, muted, bright kind of the tone, but muted as in wasn't like overwhelming yellow gelato. And I'm looking at that and I'm like, okay, what could that possibly be? And it turns out it was peach, and it was, again, fantastic. So I always shop by color. And if it's a color I haven't had or it's a weird color, that's where I start.
That's amazing. And channel Beauty and the Beast, the gray stuff, it's delicious. Don't believe me, ask the dishes. You found the gray stuff. So today, we are a little over time. I apologize, but it has been a pleasure having you on the show. You're an immense source of wisdom, and I enjoyed our conversation immensely. And I really do hope that I get to kind of take a road trip at some point and visit all of you down. You're a little bit south of me when I get brave enough to do that.
Well, it's either that, or if you go to a conference, because I work a lot of events, there's a strong chance I will be there. So I will get to do that at some point soon, I hope.
Sounds good. All right, thank you.
I've quite enjoyed it too. So thank you for inviting me.